When I construct my sermons, there's usually two criteria I try to meet. First, I want them interesting. I want them to make people think. And second, I want them to be spiritually uplifting. I'll warn you in advance that today's message may be a bit heavy on the first element and maybe a little lacking in the second. Such is the nature of the subject of genetic engineering. When I worked for ITT Industries, part of my responsibility was to sell software packages that controlled industrial processes. For example, say a company had thousands of gas wells spread over several states. Those pipes joined together and formed bigger and bigger pipes and eventually led into three or four very large stations where gas from all those wells was fed into major interstate gas pipelines. Our software-driven instruments, which opened and closed valves and regulated pressures via phone lines, radios, and satellites, automatically controlled the whole process. Now, all I did was market and sell the stuff. All I had to do was show people how to sit at their computers and order the system to increase the flow in pipe number 7, which may have been in some other state, by 10,000 cubic feet, and presto changeo, valves opened, pressures changed, and everybody was happy. I was never concerned with the behind-the-scenes computer code that made all this stuff possible, unless it wasn't working like it should. Then I would contact the software engineers and explain to them that when I ordered a valve to open in Colorado, warning lights came on in Texas, and they worked on the problem and sent me a new version of the software. And they always managed to fix the problem. But almost every single time, a brand new and unrelated problem popped up. I would frantically call them up and tell them they'd fixed the problem, but now when I download the information from Oklahoma, a process that worked flawlessly in the software before, and which is entirely unrelated to the problem they fixed, now all the gas wells in New Mexico suddenly disappeared from the computer screen. I believe anybody that's ever worked with computer code knows what I'm talking about. Everything is interrelated. When you mess around with one particular area of computer code, unexpected things happen in other areas. The reason I begin my reflections on genetic engineering with this little trip down memory lane is that there are many parallels between computer code and the genetic code. The genetic code, however, is thousands of times more complex than any computer code ever devised. And while our experience in tinkering with the genetic code is just beginning, we're already learning it can have results similar to tinkering with computer code. The results are often unforeseen, and unrelated areas seem to be connected in ways that aren't readily apparent. When I visited the Chautauqua Institution last summer, Michael Marletta, a biochemistry professor from the University of Michigan, lectured on the recently completed Human Genome Project. This is the analogy he used to explain the implications of that research. He said that physicians and medical scientists have been like automobile mechanics attempting to repair cars with no parts manual and no repair book. With the completion of the Human Genome Project, these mechanics, doctors, and scientists now have a parts list. We're just beginning to assemble a repair book, and the long-range implications for medicine are almost inconceivable. Keep that analogy in mind as I remind you of another speaker who lectured at Chautauqua, a futurist named B. Gentry Lee. Lee made lots of amazing predictions about the things he believes will happen in the next 100 years. I dedicated a sermon to his reflections last summer, and I don't want to repeat myself, but I'll remind you of a few of his predictions. If you could leap into the future and walk into a grocery store in the year 2030, 95% of the food would not be recognizable. It will be genetically engineered to be healthier. Various fruits and vegetables will have been crossed to create more efficient foods. That prediction isn't too far-fetched, by the way, considering 26% of the corn now growing in the United States of America is genetically modified. By the year 2050, corporations will harvest and fertilize eggs for potential parents who will be able to check the vital statistics of thousands of their own fertilized eggs and pick the one that best suits them. Hair color, eye color, height, weight, no problem. Beyond that, the process will involve odds. This fertilized egg has an 80% chance of being a musical genius, and that fertilized egg has a 93% chance of being a mathematical genius, and so on. Parents will be able to do this while the fertilized eggs are only a couple of days old, and they will have thousands of their own fertilized eggs to choose from. Futurists give us some interesting things to think about. I've thought a great deal about the subject of bioethics and genetic engineering over the past year, collecting articles and reading whatever I could find on the subject. This interest was spurred by something B. Gentry Lee said that I found stunning, amazing, and the more I thought about it, true. Lee said that if the human race manages to survive for a million years, the time we are living in right now will be seen as the pivotal moment in the history of our planet. Right now, the first decade of the 21st century will be looked back on by all future inhabitants of this planet as the most critical period in the Earth's 5 billion years of existence. And here's why. History will show that after 3.5 billion years of evolution, it was now, right now, that a product of that evolution, humanity, rose up and took control of the evolutionary process. With the completion of the Human Genome Project in the year 2000, the forces of nature no longer move the evolution of life on this planet. Or if you prefer, the evolution of life on Earth is no longer guided by the hand of God. Human beings have taken control of that process. That's where we are. Now, I don't want to come across like Chicken Little here, running around screaming that the sky is falling. The positive benefits of the Human Genome Project are going to be wonderful. Many of the diseases that wreak havoc on people today will be things of the past. There is much good that will come out of our knowledge of genetics. The area of stem cell research is just one of the intriguing and controversial areas in this field. Our own Senator Brownback is leading the fight against the use of embryos for stem cell research. On the other hand, Orrin Hatch, whose voting record is pretty much a mirror image of Brownback's, believes the benefits are so promising that this research must continue. Like every other area of genetic engineering, once you get down to the nitty-gritty, stem cell research is above my head and beyond my depth. But the one paragraph overview goes something like this. There are three sources of stem cells. The first two, extracting them from bone marrow or cloning them from adult cells, aren't nearly as controversial or as promising for medicine as the third, using the stem cells from embryos. This is the method that is generating all the heated debate. An egg is fertilized in a dish, and as it starts to divide, the cells are identical, blank slates that will eventually, we're not sure how and why, take on differing characteristics to form brain cells, liver cells, heart cells, and so on. Scientists are learning how to take these stem cells, these blank slates, and turn them into specialized cells for implanting in people. Why replace a person's liver, for example, if we can implant cells that will grow into healthy liver tissue? We may soon develop the ability to create cells that will cure all sorts of diseases, from Alzheimer's disease to diabetes, from heart disease to damaged spinal cords. Should we go forward with this research? Or is it immoral to fertilize an egg in a laboratory for the sake of generating stem cells? I tend to cautiously side with those who want to proceed with stem cell research. But other areas of genetic engineering are even more controversial. Some serious ethical questions arise, and I can't state this strongly enough. We have to keep ourselves informed, and our voices must be heard. This planet is not the sole property of the interests who are presently tinkering with genetic engineering. This planet belongs to us. And while I would never call for an end to research, while I believe many positive things, as evidenced from stem cell research are bound to come forth as a result of our expanding knowledge, I believe with all my heart that each of us has a right to be a part of the discussion concerning the ethics of tinkering with the future of our species. We are Homo sapiens. The process by which we evolved into what we are today was slow. If we go back in time 1 million years, we discover what was probably our immediate predecessors, Homo erectus. The changes that made Homo erectus evolve into Homo sapiens occurred over hundreds of thousands of years. We'll soon have the ability to make our own species evolve into something different. Let's call it Homo futurus. That species will be as different from us as we are from Homo erectus. The difference is it will not be the rhythms of nature and the hand of God that create these changes. We will make the changes, and they won't occur over hundreds of thousands of years. They will likely occur over the next 200 years, perhaps less. We've taken over the life force. We've appointed ourselves the mechanics and engineers of the future, but we're not preparing to design bigger, faster, more efficient cars. We're preparing to design and build a new species of human being. To put it as straightforward as possible, it is conceivable that the average human being, 200 years in the future, will be as different from you and me as we are different from the species Homo erectus we find 1 million years in the past. I don't know about you, but as far as I'm concerned, this issue makes almost every other problem we face seem trivial. I don't even like to think about it. But the process is underway, and the question, quite simply, is, who's making the rules? I think you and I deserve a voice in this matter, and we abdicate our right to that voice if we hide from the issue out of ignorance or fear. Now, we couldn't put the genetic genie back in the bottle even if we wanted to. And considering the promise the field of genetics holds for medicine, that may be just as well. There are 34,000 or so genes in every cell. And the way these genes are arranged is called their spelling. Spelling mistakes cause all sorts of problems within the individual. But genetic research is allowing doctors to target treatments to a patient's unique characteristics to overcome spelling mistakes. A few examples of how beneficial this is. The chemotherapy drugs used to treat childhood leukemia cannot be metabolized if a particular gene called TPMT is misspelled. Doctors can now make sure that gene is correctly spelled before administering the drug, which would otherwise kill the child. A misspelling of another gene leaves cells unable to break down certain antidepressants, which can then build up to toxic levels. A variant spelling of another gene leaves patients unable to metabolize certain types of anesthetics. This is what that biochemistry professor meant when he said we now have a parts list for the human body, and we can start putting together a repair manual. Every field of medicine is going to benefit from the Human Genome Project. One problem is that we live in a world where scientific advancements are made through research and experimentation. Mix in a little of that driving force behind our economic success, greed, the profit motive, and we have a recipe for disaster. Let's consider, for example, cloning. We ponder all the implications of successful cloning as we see Dolly, the amazing clone sheep, paraded before us. But what about the implications of unsuccessful cloning? At this time, fewer than 3% of cloning efforts succeed. Developmental delays, heart defects, lung problems, and malfunctioning immune systems seem to be the most common problems. One research team cloned mice that seemed perfectly normal, and when the mice grew to adulthood, they suddenly and unexplainably grew grotesquely fat. Nobody knows why. When I read that, I couldn't help but remember all those software problems I had with those gas wells. I shudder when I hear some scientists ignoring the wisdom of the broad scientific community and saying they will produce a human clone within the next few years. I assume that means they're experimenting now with a 3% success rate. Do we really want to see the results of their experiments? Even if we could perfect the process, why clone a human being? Aside from the sick, egotistical thrill one might get from having an army of younger twin brothers and sisters, there's some thought that the very wealthy would be able to have a clone of themselves made and sustained in an unconscious state simply to keep the organs alive. Then when a person needs a new heart or a new kidney, one could be used that is genetically identical to the defective one. Since there's a real ethical dilemma with keeping a human being alive but unconscious, there are those who have wondered if the brain could be intentionally underdeveloped on these organ clones so they would not technically qualify as human beings. Put them in storage and keep them alive until their parts are needed. It sounds like science fiction, doesn't it? But the science, the ability, will soon be here. Would some enterprising person perform this service for enough money? People have done a lot worse for money. These are the ethical questions we are confronted with right now. Okay, forget cloning. There's little doubt that within a few generations, mothers and fathers will have the ability to handpick their children from a collection of their own fertilized eggs. Even if we outlaw this practice, clinics will likely be established beyond America's borders where this option will be available. And given the choice between a child with an IQ of 90 or 135, wouldn't most of us pick the embryo with the higher intelligence? And if we could tweak a gene here and a gene there and assure the resulting person would be a little bigger and a little stronger, would we do it? This is the blueprint for engineering a new species. After talking about this last summer, Carrie Olson asked me to speak to her ninth grade literature class relating this subject to the great novel, Brave New World. Those were some astute students, and they picked up on the big problem right away. If everybody is a genius, who does the menial labor? Einstein would not have been especially happy washing dishes at the corner malt shop. And who wants a world full of Einsteins anyway? In Brave New World, the problem was solved by genetically engineering the proper number of people at the required intelligence levels. And while it sounds like science fiction, for our children downstairs, and almost certainly for their children, this will be a real issue in their lifetimes. What's the answer to all this? We hear some scientists taking this cavalier attitude toward the potential problems of genetic engineering, claiming those of us who are worried are simply too ignorant to understand that we should shut up and leave this in the hands of the experts. On the other extreme are people like Bill Joy. He's the co-founder and chief scientist of Sun Microsystems. Bill Joy says that even if a new gene therapy could save a child from incurable cancer, we should not do it. The long-run risks for the human race are too great. I'll quote Bill Joy. We are on the cusp of the further perfection of extreme evil, whose possibility spreads well beyond that which weapons of mass destruction bequeathed to nation states, a terrible empowerment of extreme individuals. Chicken Little? Perhaps. But he claims that in 30 years, computers will be a million times more powerful than they are now, and it may be impossible to curb their impact. And as our ability to cut and paste genetic material becomes common and fast, we may go well beyond evolving ourselves into another species. We may end the human endeavor altogether. Bill Joy insists that this easy manipulation of genetic material by accident or with evil intent, will lead to the development of virulent pathogens that will decimate entire societies, if not the entire human race. What if Charles Manson could have sat at his computer and easily produced an incurable virus that is spread through the air? Would he have done it? Are there other people out there as crazy and as evil as Charles Manson? Bill Joy asked us to consider nanotechnology, in which scientists attempt to build molecule-sized machines. The benefits will be great, especially for medicine, as microscopic search and destroy machines will be able to target cancer cells. The next step will be to make these tiny alive machines self-replicating and manufacturing them to, say, kill weeds. But life forms mutate. What if the tiny self-replicating machines designed to kill dandelions mutate into machines that kill all plant life? Well, many scientists do indeed believe that Bill Joy is a modern-day version of Chicken Little, that the sky is not falling. They remind us that the last great leap in human knowledge that held both great promise and posed remarkable threats was that of nuclear engineering. And even with the evil powers of this world, we have managed to pull back from a nuclear holocaust. As for me, frankly, I'm a little scared, but I also have faith. I have faith that we will at least be able to control the genetic genie, even if we can't put it back in the bottle. And I do believe we need to start thinking about our world in a different way. Consider this. If there were no Environmental Protection Agency, and there were no laws against pollution, would most CEOs allow their companies to pollute a river to boost this year's profits? No, I don't believe that at all, because I believe most CEOs are persons of integrity. But if there were no laws against pollution, is there any CEO who would pollute a river to boost this year's profits? Absolutely. And while one bad apple doesn't spoil the whole bunch, in this case, one bad apple can spoil the whole river. That's why, in my opinion, we need some form of environmental protection. We need strictly enforced laws protecting the masses from those rare few who would sacrifice the future of our world on the altar of greed. As for genetic engineering, I believe this is an area we simply cannot leave in the unregulated hands of free enterprise. Not because free enterprise is bad, but because this is a subject so dangerous, it may only take one Charles Manson with money and power to wreak incredible havoc on the entire human race. The technologically developed world simply must band together and move forward with great caution, with strict regulations and harsh penalties for violations of the public trust. As a species, as the human race, this is one subject where if we don't work together for the good of the whole, the consequences may be more horrific than our worst nightmares. We can't afford to look at this with a short-range plan. We have to look at the big picture. We began today's worship with a biblical proverb warning us to keep sound wisdom and prudence. We end it with the wisdom of the Native American culture. It was historically the wisdom of Native American elders to never make a decision until they considered the effect that decision would have on the next seven generations. They asked themselves, do we vote for our personal good, or do we vote for the good of the seventh generation? That's the way you and I need to start thinking. If we as a human race cannot think about the future of humanity when you and I will no longer be here to see it, do we as a species deserve to survive? That question, it appears, will answer itself in future years. May we be the ones with eyes wide open who carry hope and faith, wisdom and prudence into that future.